This is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative entrepreneur. I'm David Cadavy from Love Your Work headquarters in Colombia. Yes, the country. I've interviewed titans of industry like Steve Case. I've interviewed best-selling authors like Seth Godin and James Altucher. I've interviewed experts on behavioral science, creators from dancers to a chef to a Hollywood set designer, and visionaries on the cutting edge of creative monetization, whether that's self-publishing or blockchain technology. From these conversations, I pull out lessons to share with you on how you can find your unique voice as a creative entrepreneur, how you can nail the right mindset to succeed, and how you can be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. So if you're new here, welcome. Again, I am David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please just hit subscribe on your podcast app and get my free creative productivity toolkit. Sign up at cadavy.net/tools. You hear it all the time. You might even say it yourself. It's crazy at work. There's unrealistic deadlines. There's demanding bosses. There's wall-to-wall meetings. Jason Fried, our guest today, believes that it doesn't have to be that way. In fact, he'll tell you why in his new book. It's called It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. I love that title. Jason needs no introduction for many of you, but for everyone else, Jason is CEO of Basecamp. And Basecamp is simple yet powerful project management software. Basecamp, the software, has a long history of staying simple, even when it doesn't make intuitive sense. And it really works well, that philosophy. Basecamp, the company, with Jason at the helm, also has a long history of espousing sensible work practices, even when they don't make intuitive sense. And we're going to talk about some of those today. We're going to talk about what's the difference between deadlines and dreadlines. This is actually a really useful way to think about deadlines. How can this simple distinction help you stay in control of your projects? And how does Jason and his company struggle with it being crazy at work where they work? What do they do about it? Hear about their fascinating uphill-downhill tactic, which can help you decide whether or not to quit those projects that just don't ever seem to end. Also, hear specific ways to handle clients that make it crazy at work. Jason's going to tell you exactly what to say, guide you through a real-life scenario using the stoic technique of negative visualization. Jason was the very first guest on Love Your Work. It was great to start off the podcast with him 3 years ago now. I'm really thrilled to have him back. And also, I'm thrilled to have today's sponsor of Babbel, the number one selling language learning app in the world. I can tell you that learning a new language is one of the greatest hacks that you can do in life. I know that living in Colombia would be a huge struggle if I hadn't learned Spanish. It's like discovering a secret world on a video game. All of a sudden, I can travel to all these countries in comfort. With Babbel, you can learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and much more. You can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com or download the app and try it for free. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com, or download the app to try for free. Babbel.com. Here is Jason Fried. Jason Fried.
Hey.
It's been almost 3 years now. You were episode number one. Now we're almost at episode 150. Oh. So thank you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's been fun following along.
So you have this new book coming out, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that I love book titles that before you've even read the book, it's already done something for you. So some people will say, like, what got you here won't get you there. Like, that's a book title that you before you even read it, you've already learned a lesson from mm-hmm. it. Is that something that you think about when you choose a title for a book?
It's funny, actually. This book was originally going to be called The Calm Company. And so that was the original title. That was the working title. That was a title that the publisher agreed to when we signed the contract. Basically, I wrote the contract up or discussed doing a deal. And we'd started doing cover designs under that cover name. And everything we kind of came up with was too abstract. It was like a very quiet-looking cover, or like a Zen garden cover, or that kind of stuff. And we're like, this looks like a meditation book. Like, this is not actually representing or reflecting the content inside the book, which is actually mm-hmm. quite aggressive, rebellious, cantankerous in some ways and irreverent, which is, you know, how we tend to be in books. And we have strong opinions. We want to share those. And like the title and the cover just didn't do it. And it was interesting how the cover design made that very clear. So then, you know, the subtitle of the book was actually, It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. So it was going to be The Calm Company. It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. Hmm. And then I put together a cover concept, which really played off on the subtitle instead. And then right there it clicked. It's like, ah, that's what this book should be called. So the cover combined with the name of the book basically says everything. I don't think anyone could pick up this book, look at the cover and go, I don't know what this is going to be about.
Yeah, because The Calm Company, I think that might be a little vague, right?
It certainly was. And we use the term calm and calm company in the book a lot. But really, the real message we're making here, we're sending here, is that it doesn't have to be crazy at work. And you know, you ask people what it's like at work, and everyone's like, "Oh my god, it's crazy at work." It's crazy, and we're like, "It doesn't have to be that way." So, so my point is that we stumbled into the title. Originally, it was the subtitle. Graphic design actually forced us away from the main title, and the subtitle became the obvious answer to that.
Yeah, it's funny how by doing a cover mock-up, sometimes you can, or doing a mock-up of a lot of things, you can kind of envision the product and get an idea of what it feels like. And that can take you in an entirely new direction. So it doesn't have to be crazy at work. I love that title because the moment that I see it, it makes me realize, oh yeah, sometimes I think that it does have to be crazy at work, or there's a lot to unpack there. So I think to start off with, is crazy. Like you said, you might talk to people and say, oh, well, how are things at work? They're like, oh, it's crazy, or my week is crazy. What constitutes crazy for most people?
Well, I could run down the list on the title, on the cover of the book, which is basically the summary, which is, you know, in our opinion, it's things like really long weeks, 80-hour weeks, 60, 70, 80-hour plus weeks. People's schedules being packed full, like everyone's always packed. Like there's no time for anything. People look at their schedules and it's just like a game of calendar Tetris. It's just like colored blocks everywhere and there's no gaps basically. Or everyone's saying, I'm super busy. Or people's inbox overflowing, or people under these unrealistic deadlines that you know, someone just threw a deadline at them. They're like, there's no way, it's impossible. But they're like, we'll get it done, whatever it takes, that kind of attitude. People aren't sleeping well. They're working on the weekends. They're stuck at the office all the time. They have to pull all-nighters. If they use chat, it's blowing up all the time. There's tons of notifications and everyone's trying to get a hold of them all the time. And there's expectations of immediate response. This manic, hectic feeling does not have to be that way. It does not have to be that way. And so it's sort of those things plus a variety of other things that we're pushing hard against in this book and pushing back on and saying it does not have to be crazy at work.
Right. And to break that down again, it doesn't have to be crazy at work. In that title is, you know, the implicit, it implies the assumption that people think that it has to be crazy.
Yes.
So what happens that makes people assume that it has to be crazy at work?
Well, it's what they're used to, first off. But a big part of it is, you know, comes from the root of it really is this insatiable desire for eternal growth. And I don't mean personal growth. I mean like company growth. Every company is trying just to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that puts enormous pressure downstream for, you know, it creates the environment for all these problems. People have to push harder. Deadlines are just unrealistic. More work has to be done in less amount of time. Work keeps piling up and people keep adding things to things, but they're not willing to move deadlines. People are just taking each other's time all day. And so they have no time to do the work because their schedule is full with meetings. Well, meetings aren't really work. You've got to have time to do the actual work itself. When's that going to happen? I don't know. Maybe at 9 o'clock at night, maybe on Saturday or Sunday, you know, that's when it happens. And so, but the, you know, again, the root of it is this desire to grow at all costs. And I think that's where it all begins.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that hearing this title, it made me think a little bit about the language that I choose to describe my own schedule sometimes. So I'm sure we all do it. Every once in a while, somebody might ask how things are going and might say like, oh, it's crazy. This week is crazy. And it made me realize that when I talk that way, in a way, I'm absolving myself of responsibility. I'm becoming a victim to whatever's going on, like as if it's happening to me and it's not choices that I made.
Yeah. Or it's almost like fun. It's like, oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's like, no, it shouldn't be that way. It doesn't need to be that way. But yeah, you're right. It's kind of a cover in some ways. It's a way to say, well, that's just the way it is. It's crazy at work. Like, what am I going to do about it? But you know, and look, frankly, some people don't have the power or influence inside of an organization to necessarily change that. So it's not that, you know, I want to be fair about that. It's not that it's within everyone's immediate power to make sweeping changes. So it isn't crazy at work. But first it's a recognition, and then it's, you know, what can you do in your own local area, basically, like wherever you are. Maybe it's just you, maybe it's your team, maybe it's one other coworker, you know, that sort of thing. Maybe you can stop bothering other people. If you're being bothered all the time, maybe you should stop interrupting other people for a while. Like basically the old Gandhi quote, be the change you wish to see in the world. You know, like if you want things to be better around you and you don't like the way other people are treating you at work or the way work is treating you, not even other people necessarily, because oftentimes it's systematic or systemic, I mean, or both, I guess, that, you know, what can I do? What can I do to stop this trend? And then hopefully, you know, that rubs off on other people or you mention it here and there and other people start to pay attention to this and they go, it shouldn't be that crazy either. Why am I doing this to everybody? Why are we doing it this way? And you get a chance to reevaluate.
If I examine myself a little bit for those times when I do say that it's crazy, like a little bit of it is pleasurable in a way, because it makes me feel important. And it also, and like I said, it also makes it seem like it's happening to me and it's not something that I have control of. And you make a good point. You know, not everybody can have the control in work to make things not crazy, but I would venture to guess that there's a lot of people who have more power than they think that they do to make things not crazy, and they're not always able to take that opportunity. Is that something that you agree with?
Yeah, I mean, because a lot of this, you know, a lot of the stuff in the book is pointed at business owners, entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, or whatever, you know, that term is, where, you know, people are like, well, my client requires me to be available 24/7. It's like, no, they do not require you to be that way. And if they do, you have to tell them that that's unreasonable. Like, you cannot let everyone else drive your situation. In some cases, of course, like if you're an employee in an organization that's large and you really have no power, really, okay, maybe I get that. I can understand that. But a lot of people who actually do have the power over their situation still allow other people to create their situation. And it's unfortunate. And one of the biggest ones really is the client services world, where people are like, well, what do I do if my client writes me back at 10 p.m.? They expect an answer. I'm like, well, tell them that you don't work at 10 p.m. Just tell them, like, you're an adult, they're an adult, they're going to be reasonable. And if they fire you because they expect you to be available at 10 p.m., good riddance, goodbye. I cannot be on call. I'm not a doctor. I'm not on call 24/7. These are not emergencies. These are not emergency surgeries. You know, if someone doesn't like the color or they don't like the layout, it's not an emergency. You can talk about that tomorrow morning. So it just, people have to remember that they do have control over those situations if they're willing to speak up for themselves, and everyone should.
It seems like it's kind of assumptions or stories that, yeah, maybe your client doesn't like it the most when you decide to set that boundary, but in a lot of cases, they'll go ahead and live with it. But if you don't set the boundary, then you make the assumption that that's going to be this relationship ender.
Right.
And then you allow that to invade your own life.
Or you're afraid. Like, the other thing I hear a lot is you know, people mention this to me. I'm like, well, did you tell your client that, like, you know, that you don't work at 10 p.m.? And they're like, no, I can't tell them that. I'm like, what do you mean you can't tell them that? Why can't you tell them that? And they're actually afraid. They've never even broached the subject and they're afraid of the response. But I'm certain that most people are reasonable and will understand. It's like, you know, I end my day at 6 or whatever. I'll get right on it in the first thing in the morning. That's a totally reasonable thing to say. Or like, I'm eating dinner or I'm with my family, you know, after work, like totally reasonable things to say. And even clients who are hardened in a sense, like they're going to understand that because they live life too. And they're going to have similar situations in their life. So you just have to be a fair and honest person, a reasonable person. Go, look, I will get back to you first thing in the morning. And you know, if you don't get emails from me at 9 o'clock at night, it's because I'm with my family. And, but, you know, first thing in the morning, I'll check your stuff and I'll get right back to you. And I think that's totally fair.
Now, as somebody who writes books myself, I'm often trying to find in myself the motivation to write a book on a particular topic. And the more that I look at it, the more I find that it's got to be something that I'm kind of experiencing myself and something that I want to instill in myself. But when I look at you and I look at you writing a book like this, you strike me as somebody who doesn't seem to struggle with making it not crazy at work. So I kind of wonder where do you come in contact with this idea of things being crazy at work and people assuming that it has to be crazy at work so much to the point that you're able to motivate yourself to write a book on this topic?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the things in the book are things we've lived through ourselves. We've for the most part run a calm company, but we've learned a lot about how to do that over the years. So this book is a collection of our own experiences and changes. So a lot of the essays in the book start out with like, this is how we think it should be. And by the way, it wasn't this way for us for a while. Here are some of the changes we had to make to get there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on balance, I think we've done it well for a long period of time, but there's always things we haven't. I think, for example, one really good example of this in the book is there's a chapter or an essay on what we call office hours. So for a long time, I'll step back. We have a lot of experts at the company, right? There's some people who are just experts at JavaScript or experts at writing or experts at this or experts at that, or they know the backend systems really well, or they know our billing system better than anybody else. So there are these people in the company that people look to for answers when they don't know the answer to something. And for the longest time, they would just, you know, ask that person a question like whenever they wanted, which is like on a one-off basis, a reasonable thing to do, but not if it's the 19th question that person's fielded that day, because they have work to do themselves. The expert has work to do themselves. The expert is not just an oracle on the top of a mountain waiting for questions. You know, they're busy with their own work. And so what we realized was that we had to institute something called office hours, which is, of course, not an original idea. We took the idea from academia, basically, which is that, you know, if you want to talk to Sam about JavaScript, Sam's, let's say, our resident JavaScript expert. If you want to talk to Sam about that, Sam's available. I'm just making this up here in terms of his actual schedule, but he's available from 3 to 5 p.m. or 2 to 5 p.m. every Wednesday. He'll hold office hours during that time, and you can sign up to speak with him, and he will give you his full undivided attention for that time and help you through your problem. Versus the other alternative, which is him being distracted all day long by other people's questions, and then also him not being able to really give someone a full, complete, focused answer because he's got other things on his mind at that time. But now he can clear his schedule, he can clear his time, he can focus on you, and you know that you're going to get his full undivided attention. So we implemented office hours, and it's been a great hit. And a lot of different groups in the company have it now. So there's programmers, designers, strategy, different people have it in the company. And so that was something we only did a year or so ago, maybe a little bit longer. But for a long time, we just kind of lived the other way, and we didn't even notice that it was crazy until we started to hear more about it from people like, gosh, you know, I feel bad about bothering him all the time, or someone saying who's being bothered all the time, saying like, or interrupted. And bother is a strong word, but in a sense it is like, you know, I'm having a hard time getting my work done because I'm fielding questions all day. I'm happy to answer people. I love to help. I want to help, but I can't just help because I have my own things to do. So we're set like, what can we do about this? And we came up to that conclusion. So like, that's kind of our approach. It's an iterative approach. The idea is that your company itself, how it functions, is also a product. That we all know how to iterate and make a product better, but a lot of people don't iterate on their company, on the company itself, or the procedures or the policies in place itself. And they just kind of, once they do it a certain way, they just stick with it. And we're always trying to iterate on the company itself. So that was one example of how things got better over time.
Yeah. And it seems like in a lot of cases, it's sort of standards of social conduct that can get in the way of business operations in a way. Like, it seems like it should be fine to go up and tap another human on the shoulder and talk to them. And in some ways it is, but when you're trying to operate as a business, then sometimes these things like that, or like telling a client or not responding to a client right away, there's these things that it seems like it feels like you're going to offend somebody to lay down these ground rules. And that's why nobody does it in the first place.
Right. But, you know, you're right. But like, what's the alternative? So in every situation, there's a trade-off. Everything has a trade-off. And so the trade-off actually in that situation is like, is not saying anything and just dealing with it for a long period of time, which is like long-term resentment, crazy feelings at work. Like people don't have time to get what they need done. So they end up having to eat away at life and they have to work late nights or on the weekends. And so there are ramifications to just ignoring that as well. So it's not that ignoring it makes it go away or means it's not a problem. It's actually always a problem. And there are side effects and there's shrapnel basically. And so, you know, we think just addressing it head on and being fair about it and talking it through and coming up with a solution and trying a solution, maybe it's not the right solution, you make another one or come up with another one, but got to address this stuff. Because if you don't, it just kind of lingers and then that's no way to fix anything. So, you know, again, not confronting it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And in fact, oftentimes what's underneath the surface is far worse than what it's going to be if you just address it head on and kind of bring it to the surface and deal with it.
Now, I imagine a lot of this stuff that's in the book, you learned a very, very long time ago. And I know for myself, if I'm trying to motivate myself to write a book, there's got to be some element to it that I want to learn now. I don't know if you work that way where maybe there is a belief that you have and you just haven't been able to internalize it and live by it. And somehow by writing about it, you are able to hold yourself accountable to that belief. Is there anything about that in this book that, you know, you currently aspire to live by or that you want to internalize yourself now?
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, I think early in the book, we basically say like, we don't always live up to the book. We try. The idea is this is what we want it to be like. And this is what it's like most of the time, but we slip as well. So we have room to improve ourselves. So in some ways, this book becomes our handbook in a way. Like this is how we want to run our business. And if we find ourselves slipping, we can remind ourselves, hey, go to page 62 and remember that thing we talked about office hours, or we wrote about calendar sharing or whatever it might be. And this is our ideal. So we don't write books necessarily to learn from the material. We feel like we don't write research books, I should say. Like we don't go out and research the material. This is stuff that we write after we've lived it. And then we sort of put it down. We put it down in words and on paper and make it official and sort of get it out of our head in a sense. That's sort of how we approach it. But again, still, the book is a model. It's the model version of us. It's not the always version of us.
Well, it makes sense because Basecamp, you know, your company now, it was a product that you built for yourself.
Yeah.
And so there's something powerful about writing a book that is written in order for you to refer to it yourself.
That's how we do everything here and always have, which is we always build what we need first. We are the first customer of anything that we make. And we're the first customer and the oldest customer, essentially, meaning that we keep using what we make. And if we don't use what we make, it tends to not be as good as it could be. We've seen some examples of that. So I think the book is, again, like we are essentially a customer of the book. This is the stuff we try to live by and we try to do as best we can. And we falter and slip sometimes, just like any human being does in any situation. But this is where we want to be. And this is what we believe. So there's nothing in the book that we don't believe. There's nothing in there for calculated effect to act one way, but work another. Certainly there are things, there's a degree to which different groups within the company, live up to these ideals. And some groups are a little bit different than others in terms of what they're capable of doing, given the type of work that they do. So it's not a homogenous, no company's homogenous in that way. So even like, for example, we talk a little bit about how we work in these 6-week cycles. We do 6 weeks of work at a time and then take 2 weeks off, not 2 weeks off of work, but 2 weeks off of dedicated project work. Well, some teams in the company don't have project work, so they don't necessarily work on the 6-week cycle. So that's more for the product development side of the business. And some other teams do follow it as well, but not all. So not all of the stuff applies to everybody in the company, but fundamentally, basically, these are our ideals and our principles that we want to hold dear, even if they don't necessarily always apply directly in the same way to every group, but they apply philosophically to the whole. And that's what we're trying to do.
Now, in the process of examining this question of why it doesn't have to be crazy at work, through the process of examining that, did you come across new philosophies or new policies that you wanted to implement that you probably wouldn't have thought about otherwise if you had not been making this concentrated effort to think about this topic and put it into a book?
That's a great question, and I'm certain there were, and I'm just sort of struggling right now to remember them. I don't actually even have a copy of the book in front of me right now to reference quickly, but certainly there were some things I think that we came to a clearer understanding of as we wrote them down. And I find very few things really focus to mind. You know, there's two things, but like, if you have to teach someone something, you really better know what you're talking about. And it like is a very quick way to figure out if you know what you're talking about. And the other was writing something down and like reading it back and go, does this make any sense? So I think that, you could say the book is a sharpener and we're an axe. You know, we already have a blade. We have a tool here, but the book sharpened it, writing the book sharpened it and reminded us what was important and what wasn't about being calm at work. So I think that's how I'd probably see this book as a sharpener for us, but for others, it'll be a blade because they don't have anything like this already.
And can you talk about this 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off policy?
Yeah, I mean, policy is probably strong, but working. Yeah. So basically, the product teams, let's just say the team that primarily works on Basecamp, we'll just simplify it, Basecamp on the web, works in what we call 6 week cycles. And these cycles mean that every 6 weeks, we decide what projects we're going to work on over the next 6 weeks. Those projects cannot take any more than 6 weeks, but they can take less than 6 weeks. Sometimes it's one or two projects. Sometimes it's four or five, depending on the size. Some only take a week each. Some take 4 weeks. Some take the full amount. If they take the full amount, we typically only do one or two of those. If they take a few weeks at a time, we'll typically do four or five. Teams are divided into small groups of two or three people per team. We have a few teams working on the stuff over those 6 weeks. Each team takes on a specific project. So we don't have two teams working on the same project. So for example, let's just say like, we just added recurring events to the Basecamp schedule, which allows people to add events that, you know, repeat every month or every week or every day or whatever. That was, I think three people on that team worked on that for the duration of the cycle. And then when it's done, it's done. We take 2 weeks between cycles to, kind of first off clean up anything that we sort of left a little bit messy, and or take on a few personal projects that we wanted to get to that weren't slated for that cycle, but some quick fixes we could make or quick cleanups we could do. It allows people to sort of roam as almost like internal freelancers and just help around and see who else needs help with something that someone, you know, developer support might need something fixed in the online, in the centralized billing system or something. And someone on, on the product team could just flip over there and fix something really quick for them or something like that. And it also gives us a chance to think about the next cycle a bit, form our thoughts, and then get going 2 weeks from now on the next batch of work. So that's basically the cadence and how we do it. And in the book, we talk about this idea of deadlines versus dreadlines. And a lot of people have dreadlines, which are deadlines that they dread. We try, not always, again, this is like we're not, you know, perfect here either, but we try to make sure that our deadlines are actually things people are excited about, which means the project's going to end. They're helpful things. They help us scope down work that's too big. They help us make decisions and make cuts. These are our friends, basically. Deadlines are our friends. Dreadlines, however, are deadlines you know you're not going to make. More and more work gets piled in, but no more time is given. Unreasonable demands are made. And that's what a lot of people live under are dreadlines. And that's why a lot of people don't like deadlines, is because they're actually dreadlines. And so we're trying to be really careful about that. But that's what the 6 week cycle is all about, is setting a clear limit. And the other nice thing about 6 weeks is that if you're on a project you don't like, it's almost over before you started. Like, the worst thing is being stuck on something you don't like for a long period of time, or even being stuck on something you like for a long period of time. The worst projects and the most demoralizing projects are ones that never seem to end. They go on and on and on, and you have no idea when they're ever going to see the light of day, and they could be killed in the end. You just don't know. At the very least, if you don't like the project or ends up not working out over 6 weeks, like, and we kill the project, it was only 6 weeks. And we're about to start another 6 weeks in 2 weeks. So it's not that big of a deal.
We're going to take a quick break. Thank you to our sponsor today, Gusto. Payroll and benefits are hard, especially when you're a small business. You don't have time to be an expert on things like taxes and regulations, and old school payroll providers just aren't built for the way you work today. Gusto is making payroll, benefits, and HR easy for small businesses. Modern technology does the heavy lifting, so it's easy for you to get it right. You no longer have to be a big company to get great technology, great benefits, and great service for your team. To help support the show, Gusto is offering our listeners an exclusive limited time deal. Sign up today. You'll get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/loveyourwork. That is gusto.com/loveyourwork. I love having Earth Class Mail as a sponsor. That is Earth Class Mail. You know, like Earth that you're probably on right now, not First Class Mail, Earth Class Mail. What Earth Class Mail does is it digitizes your physical mail. It puts it online in a secure portal, and you can check your mail from anywhere in the world. Never be tied to a physical location. That is so cool. You can imagine how much I love that. And you never have to waste time taking another trip to the bank to deposit checks. You know, you get checks from clients and other places that you make money. Earth Class Mail's tech automatically will recognize checks. With their check stream service, Earth Class Mail will endorse and deposit checks to your bank account on your business's behalf. You never have to touch it. With Earth Class Mail, you can transform your office into a paperless environment. Scan documents, mail, other important items like invoices, receipts, they're all turned into fully searchable PDFs. Earth Class Mail has set up a special offer just for Love Your Work listeners. So listen up, if you want to get 8% off the monthly plan or 10% off an annual contract, visit earthclassmail.com and use the promo code LOVEYOURWORK when you sign up. That's earthclassmail.com with the promo code LOVEYOURWORK. What I find really interesting about this 6 week, 2 week cycle thing is that I see it as putting your mind in two different states in each of those. Because I can imagine on the 6 week cycle, when you have defined work that you're trying to drive toward, you can very easily get distracted by loose ends that kind of need to be taken care of. But at the same time, if you continue to drive forward toward trying to get a particular thing done, those loose ends that need to be attended to, in my experience, the way that I tend to work, I'll just not do them. And then things get disorganized, things get, you know, might be like revamping my, organizing my file system or something like that. These things that they take time and effort to look at, but they take you away from doing goal-oriented, get this done work. And they need to be done, but if you give them the space to do them, then they can get done. So is that something that you experience with this cycle as well?
Ideally, yes. Not always in reality, but ideally, yeah. And it's kind of like if you could almost think about fasting. So, you know, normally you're eating food, and your body is, you know, working on digesting, breaking down food, sorting out the nutrients, goes through your intestinal system, it's extracted, like all this stuff, right? Like your body's working hard when you eat. And sometimes if you just give it a break and you fast for a day or whatever, different lengths, but like your body just gets a chance to clean itself up a little bit. And it's like that. It's just like you said, like, when do you ever have time to like reorganize your desktop or even like that's on the computer, but even like reorganize your office? If you have a physical desk and a physical space, like when do you have time for those kinds of things? You need to do some house cleaning. And, if you're just jumping from project to project to project to project, you know, you're never going to slate in time for those moments. So this break, this 2 weeks, although it's not a break, but it's just a different, like I like the, you know, way you kind of put it. It's just a different mindset shift and different kind of work can happen during that time versus when you're, you know, heads down, focused on a bigger project that's going to take time versus like being able to knock out three or four things in a given day. Like, let me just clean up my desk or this pile of papers. I just need to go through them or I got to pay these bills or I want to fix this thing that's been bugging me on the website or whatever it is. Like, those are projects that never get slated. So let's just like slate a bucket of time to deal with the stuff that you kind of want to handle.
And I think a key word for it also is permission.
Right.
You need permission to tell yourself that, yes, it actually is important for me to organize my desk.
Totally. Yeah. It's like, in some ways, it's like self-care, but focused in on the company, although also in yourself, but in your work life, you know, it's just like the company is giving you permission to have some space to wander, to freelance, to help others or help yourself any way you see fit over the next 2 weeks. It's work related. You know, you can't, it's not a vacation. You don't get 2 weeks off, but there's always stuff that you've been wanting to do or that you've annoyed, that's been annoying you about the product or something that you can just fix that doesn't require like fundamental approval. It's just like, this is bad. There's something bad here. I can just fix really quick or whatever. So that's the idea.
Now, I'm always interested in figuring out how a person ended up doing the things that they're doing. And, you know, having talked to you before and having listened to a ton of interviews of you, it's interesting to me that, like, for example, last time you were on here, you recommended the book, The Mayo Clinic Guide for Stress-Free Living. Like, it seems like sometimes you are actively trying to eliminate worry from your life or worry from your own thoughts, yet you have this seemingly extremely laissez-faire approach to work where, okay, these details that people get obsessed about, we're just not going to worry about that. We're not going to have KPIs. We're not going to have goals and measuring things, and we're not going to plan things way, way far in advance. So it kind of made me wonder, like, do you kind of have a propensity to worry about things? And then this approach that you have to work, you know, pushes you in the other direction and keeps you out of that. Is that something that it does for you?
I definitely have a propensity to worry a little bit more on the personal side of life than I do at work. And perhaps that's just because work's been working out for me well over 25 years or so. And it's just like, I basically have realized that all the stuff I used to worry about doesn't really matter. And in fact, a lot of things I didn't worry about didn't need to be worried about either. So it's not like I screwed up because I didn't worry about things, or it's not because I screwed up because I did worry about things. It's just, you kind of realize over time that a lot of the things that you deal with on a day-to-day basis just don't matter that much. And you can skip most of these things. And I just, one thing I don't like is wasting time. I really don't like that. That's like one of the few things I don't like. And whenever I run into that situation, and wasting your time can take a lot of different forms. It can be like repeating yourself over and over and over and over, which is one of the reasons why at Basecamp, we don't have a lot of meetings. Instead, we write things up. We write stuff down in long form. So it's published to Basecamp and anybody can go check it out whenever they want to, versus, you know, like, we don't have a verbal tradition at Basecamp. We have a written tradition. And a lot of companies have verbal traditions. They're in meetings all the time. And if someone wasn't there, someone has to repeat themselves and say, well, what happened there? When I wasn't there, I missed this meeting. What happened? At Basecamp, we write everything up instead. Therefore, people can say something once. And it seems subtle, perhaps, but it's not. It's not subtle at all. It's actually a significantly different way of working. And so I don't like repeating myself, for example. I don't like sitting in meetings that are a waste of time. I don't like doing a lot of these things. So I just kind of stay away from those things and I try to avoid hassles wherever I possibly can in all forms of life, work and personal. I think it's a moving target though. I mean, like, over time, things have changed. I'm sure when I was 21, I was a little bit more like go-getterish, you know, and maybe worked a little bit longer perhaps than I do now. But I do know that, I've always been very careful about not setting up bad habits. I've tried to be, at least. Certainly in some situations I have set up bad habits, but in most cases I try not to, because I'm aware that the things you do over and over and over are the things you basically will always do. And this is why I tend to be really clear with people who are starting out. At least I try to be. At least this is my advice. Of course, people do whatever they want and will, and should, by the way, do whatever they want. People have to learn things on their own, of course. But it's, you know, people say, well, I'll just bust my ass in my 20s and then I'll be good. And it's like, it just doesn't work that way. Most of the time, the people who are, you know, busting their ass in their 20s are busting their ass in their 30s and their 40s and their 50s until they can't anymore. Not because they choose not to, but because they're tired or their personal life is a mess because they've wrecked it because they're at work all the time. And that can happen you know, because if you just are so used, your first 10 years of your career are used to just working forever, whatever their spare time, you fill it with work. Well, you're always going to do that. That's the habit you're going to form. It's no different than any other habit that you have. So I think you just need to be really careful about that. Otherwise, you find yourself in a really bad spot.
Yeah. When you say that you used to worry about things that turned out to not be that big of a deal, do you have an example of that?
I feel like I may have given this example 3 years ago on your podcast, but I don't remember. So it was about, maybe you remember. I'll just give you that.
I will remember.
Okay. Was it did I ever talk about writing proposals?
Yes.
Okay. So like, that's the best example I have in the short term.
We can review that.
I'll recap just it, basically. I used to think way back in the day when I was doing client work that I had to write these elaborate proposals. And I remember staying up late writing elaborate proposals, 10, 20 page proposals, just really detailed and formatting the hell out of them and making them look beautiful and the whole thing, right? And I just ended up getting sick of that because I would lose some projects and be like, I put in a lot of time and I lost this project. And well, it wasn't because of the proposal, obviously. Otherwise, I would have won the project. So it was something else. So what if I stop putting in all this effort on the proposal side and start doing less on the proposal side? Let's see what happens there. And it turned out like my hit ratio is about the same. I didn't seem to lose work if I made simpler proposals until I eventually ended up with single one-page proposals. And a big part of that came down from my own personal experience looking at other people's proposals. So what I was doing, like a renovation for a kitchen or bathroom or something, this was a long time ago, so I don't remember exactly what it was, but I got a proposal from a contractor. And you know, what do you do when you get a proposal? You turn to the back page and look for the price and the time frame. Like, how much is this going to cost me? How long is it going to take? That's what everybody wants to know. And if you've already asked someone for a proposal, you already have vetted them, hopefully at some level, saying like, if this is a good number, I'll hire this person. So given that, you don't need to go out and prove yourself over and over and over in proposals because no one reads them anyway. What they're looking for is, what is this going to cost and how long is it going to take? And so I started doing these one-page proposals focused primarily on, here's the big number and here's how long it's going to take. And yeah, here's basically how it's going to go. But that was the fine print, was how it's going to go. And the major print, the headline, was the price and time. So that's an example of realizing that I didn't have to worry about and put myself through this agony, really, it was, of putting together long, detailed proposals. So that's one example. I mean, there are many, many others. And I'm trying to think of others like off the top of my head, but right now I'm just blanking because that's the one that always like comes to mind first.
Yeah. I'm amazed at how almost the exact same that story was from the way that you told it 3 years ago.
Because so, it's true. And that's the thing. Like, if it's a true story, I don't have to remember how, like, I told it.
The pacing and the way that the words and the phrases are put together is so similar. And it just makes me think, because I don't know, I'm one of these people, I'm constantly writing things. And I'm one of these people that if I'm on a podcast, most of the things I'm saying, I've already written this before.
Sure.
You know, maybe it wasn't publicly published or something like that, or I've practiced it on people that I'm having dinner with or something like that. It's like this universe of thoughts that come together to make this cohesive thing. And so it makes me curious about the way that you operate, because I wonder, like, do you tell that story a lot?
No, I've told it a handful of times, but not a lot, but it's like, that's what happened. So it's so easy to recall and recant because it's just exact, or not recant, recall. I guess, what word was I looking for there? I'm not sure, but, to recall, because it is what it is. And, you know, I think actually another sort of example of using, you know, it's the client example I gave earlier, which is like thinking that I had to respond to clients basically immediately. And if mm-hmm. I didn't, they would fire me. Like, no, not that way. And I don't remember how I eventually realized that. It was probably like a mistake or an accident. Like, for example, my power went out one night. I'm just making this up because I don't know if this is true, but I'm just thinking back. Like, it could have been as simple as like my power went out one night and I wasn't able to get an email from a client until the next morning. And, you know, the world didn't end. Yeah. Oh my God. The world didn't end. I thought the world was going to end if I didn't get back to people immediately. If my client was asking me a question at 9 p.m., that meant they deserved, or they not deserved, by the way, expected an answer immediately. Like, turns out, no. And so I don't know how I came to that, but I eventually came to it very clearly. And then I just began to set the tone. If I ever saw something unreasonable, It's like, I don't have to live with that. It doesn't have to be that way. And by the way, if they have to have it that way, and if they can't live without that, then we don't have to live together, basically, is the way you can look at that. And there's plenty of clients out there, and there's plenty of opportunities out there, and there's plenty of people who are reasonable out there. I don't want to do work for unreasonable people. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. So, you know, those are the, like, sometimes they're really small examples, sometimes they're much bigger examples, but most of the things, I would just say most of the things you worry about don't happen or don't matter anyway. And it's kind of interesting. Now I practice a lot of negative visualization, which is sort of like a stoic approach to things, which is to figure out, like, think about, like, what's the worst that can happen in any situation and sort of come to terms with that and figure it out and look at it from different perspectives and just be like, okay, if that happened, that would probably be the worst thing that could possibly happen. And I'm prepared for that. If that happens, as prepared as I can be. And what you finally realize is that in most cases, that terrible thing never ever happens. And so you just begin to realize that over and over, it's good to be prepared for it. But then you sort of take stock and go, man, I really could have worried about that constantly. And realize, like, it's better for me just to put it out of my mind, think about it and put it out of my mind versus, like, worrying about it constantly and assuming the worst is going to always happen. So if you assume the client's going to fire you, or you assume you must write the long proposal, or you assume you must have a stand-up meeting every Monday morning because that's what you're supposed to do, you know, and then you're never going to break that habit. But once you kind of realize that you don't have to do it and you don't do it once, and you realize, like, the company doesn't fold and the sky doesn't fall and no one dies. And it's pretty good, actually. It's pretty good. You can skip these things. And you start skipping them more frequently. And you're like, now I have more time and I didn't need to do these things. And wow, what a burden has been lifted. And it's so liberating to not have to do things. It's funny. Everyone's so obsessed with doing stuff, more things. Like, I take pleasure in doing fewer things. It's a pleasure to lift that burden. And then you're left with time, which is something no one seems to have enough of. You actually have plenty of it. You have more than enough of it. It's just that a lot of people apply the wrong things to it, so it goes away. But if you stop doing the things you don't need to do, you end up with an ample supply of it, and then you can apply it to the things that you really do want to focus on. And then you're in a really good spot. And so that's where I've landed. And it's not, like, without effort, constant effort. Sometimes I end up doing things I don't want to do, but once you get there, I think you're in a really good position. I think that's sort of the aim for, I would encourage people to aim at that.
I feel like a lot of it is understanding your worth in the situation. So if we were to take the negative visualization of, okay, my boss or my client emailed me at 9 p.m. and they don't get any response until tomorrow morning. Well, worst, the horrible thing that you're imagining is that you're going to get fired. But also, that would make no sense for your boss or your client to do that, because how much of a pain would it be for them to, you know, they've hired your services, they've paid you some sort of a retainer or some sort of advance on the work. And because 12 hours surpass that they don't hear from you, they decide that they're going to go through that entire project, that entire thing again of finding a different person. It's just not that realistic. And if it were to happen, then you're probably better off not working with that person.
Exactly. I mean, you just played it out right there, which is, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen, right? So I don't respond to the client at 9. So the worst thing that could happen is, I mean, you could really go really far. You can go, the worst thing that could happen is they could sue me for negligence or something like that, which, like, okay, what's the probability of that actually happening? Okay, let's call it zero, or close to zero. The other worst thing that could happen, let's say, is just like they fire me and they say, you're unreliable. Okay. So is that, like you said, is that really going to happen? Like, it could happen. If it happens and they've shown their cards, I don't want that, what they have in their deck. I don't want them. But realistically, let's say the worst thing that can really probably maybe happen is they can write me in the morning and go, hey, you know, I asked you this question. I didn't hear back from you. And that's actually an opportunity now. It's not really the worst thing that can happen. It's an opportunity for you to go, hey, thanks for that. By the way, I was with my family last night. I can't respond to emails at 9 o'clock at night. I hope you can appreciate that, or whatever, however you'd say it. But as you can see, it's 9:05 and I just got into work at 9, and first thing in the morning, I got right back to you. So I'm perfectly, you're a priority for me. Happy to get back to you first thing in the morning. But, and then, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? They can go, well, fuck that. Fuck you. You deserve, you know, I deserve a response at 10 o'clock at night. Like, that's not going to happen. And if it does, great. Now you know who these people are. You know, it's just, it's, when you just break it down and think it through, you realize that like all these fears and concerns are so unfounded most of the time. And when they're well-founded, it's actually a great time to pull the ripcord and get out of there, or jump off the plane, or whatever metaphor you want to use, and then pull the ripcord. But it's time to leave that situation. So anyway, it is a good example. I think we've probably belabored this for a while, but it is a good moment for you to reflect, I think.
One of the things I think that happens that makes things crazy at work, at least in my experience of being an employee, is piled on complexity.
Yeah.
Is that something that you notice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we talk about actually in the book, one of the essays is, I think it's called Narrow As You Go, which is this idea that after, let's say we have a 6-week project that's going to take the full 6 weeks. The first week, 10 days, like it's possible at that point, the project might get a little bit larger than we thought as we dig in a little bit deeper into like the domain and the problem area. But after that, the project should be getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And if it's not, you've got a problem. Because if things get bigger over time, they're more complicated, they're going to take longer, and you've got a problem. So projects should be getting smaller as you go, not larger as you go. And it's a really important distinction. Of course, this is after that like initial little bump where you might discover something new as you in the early, early stages. But you should not be discovering big things at the end, and things should not be piling on as you go. So it should really look like a gradual ease down versus an ease up. Very important. And I think it's a good idea to pay attention to that shape of the work that you do. So you can begin to realize that. Like if you really think about the shape of the project at any given time, you can just say like, if I was to look back a week from now, is it narrower or wider than the shape is right now? And if it's wider, you're probably going the wrong direction.
Yeah, and I think that there's some biases at play here that people think, oh, we'll just add on this one thing. And it's almost like, I don't know where this is going to go, because this is not something I've written down before. But if you have a room full of people and you have people guess, well, how many people have the same birthday? And most people get it wrong. The chances are actually quite high that in a room of 40 people or something, that two people are going to have the same birthday. And the same kind of sort of mathematical error happens when it comes to complexity in a way, is that if you have, a project is simplified, it's got two things. Now you went on a third thing and you didn't just change it from 2 to 3. You changed it from 2 to 9 because of the interrelationship between those things, goes beyond our comprehension in terms of complexity. And that seems to be one of the things that makes it harder to meet a deadline than you expect it to be, because that complexity is so much more than it seems like it is when you're just adding on this one little thing.
Yes. I mean, every additional thing now interacts with all the other things. So it's not one thing. Let's say you have 10 things, now you had an 11th. It's not one more thing. It's one thing that interacts with 10 other things in some way. So you just added, this is an abstract explanation, of course, but you just added probably like 10 additional layers of things that could go wrong, or things that could happen, or things you may not have considered, or edge cases, or whatever, or none. It's possible that it was really, truly just one extra thing, of course, but in most cases, it's not. And it's also, the other thing is that, it's rarely just one more thing. it's one more thing, and then, oh, that wasn't so bad. How about one more thing? And you keep going to this one more thing. It's very rarely one. And so if you just get into that habit of continuing to add things as you go, the project gets wider. And if it gets wider, it's much harder to close the gap as you get coming down to the end of the deadline, or you blow right through it. And look, we've missed deadlines. We just missed one recently. And it happens. You have to understand where you're at though at that point in the project. So for example, the way we vision it is, we have this thing called hill charts built into Basecamp, and basically hill chart divides a project into two fundamental phases, which is, are we going uphill or downhill? Uphill means the project's full of uncertainty still. We're still learning things as we go. Downhill means it's all about execution. We just need to finish this stuff that we already know how to do. And if we blow through a deadline and we're on the downslope and close to the end, then it's like, we know that we can act. This is just a matter of time and execution. We can finish this in 3 or 4 more days. But if we're still on the upslope on anything and we blow through a deadline, the project basically killed at that point, because it means there's too much that we don't know and we're out of time. This could go on forever. So it's really important to know where you're at if you do happen to occasionally go past a deadline.
Yeah. Jason, this has been so great to chat with you again. The book is It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. Everybody should absolutely go out and buy this book. Thank you so much for being on the show. Hopefully we'll talk again in 3 years.
Thanks, David. I hope so. This is really fun. Always fun to talk to you. Thanks again.
Is Love Your Work helping you find the intersection on your love and money Venn diagram? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation to make you into the person that you want to be? If so, we, together, you and I, can make this the show that we want it to be. I'm trying to make a nourishing and thoughtful show, and I could use your help with that. Please donate to the show. Just a coffee a month will help support the hosting and production of this show. Just a coffee a month will help spread Love Your Work's message, helping more people live a balanced life with a healthy definition of success. To donate, visit our Patreon page at katavi.net/donate. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going at katavi.net/donate. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at katavi.net/donate. That's katavi.net/donate. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Roxana Maynard of Agility Alchemist at agilityalchemist.com, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pankovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More, by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.